an introduction to the idea of thinking about sort of modeling causal processes. We're not going to hear a talk that's going to lay out the methods behind what's probably the sort of causal modeling method that's gotten the most attention in the last few years, which is the dynamic causal modeling approach developed by the folks in London. And so our speaker today is Marta Garrido. Marta is currently a postdoctoral fellow here at UCLA and has been doing a lot of work to develop methods and apply methods related to dynamic causal modeling. She's going to give an overview of that method. So thank you.
Okay, thank you for this opportunity. I'm going to talk about dynamic causal modeling, which is a hypothesis-driven method for understanding brain connectivity, and most of the work, as Russ said, was done in London by Carl Friston and his group, and especially I would like to thank Klaus, Stefan, and Andrea Marange, which work I'll be mostly talking about. So there are different approaches to look to understand cortical organization, and mainly we can split them into two: functional specialization, which looks at regionally specific effects, whereas functional integration is interested in how these different brain areas are interacting and communicating between each other. Within functional integration, there are different methods that can be split into different approaches. Functional connectivity that looks at correlations between remote regions, and these methods are very useful, as we heard before, and they are independent of how the causes, or they are independent of the underlying causes. So these are also called model-free approaches. In the domain of effective connectivity, there's various different methods, but they all more or less require a mechanism or a generative model of how these brain responses were caused. So these are model-driven approaches, and there are various different methods. I'll be talking about only on DCM. So of course this is model-driven, so there's no point on running such a model if you don't have a good hypothesis for how your biological system is behaving. So the outline of my talk, first I'll be showing a toy example to hopefully explain you how DCM works, and I'll be starting with a very simple dynamic system and then gradually increase its complexity. Secondly, I'll be talking about how is it that we estimate the parameters and how do we make model comparison or hypothesis comparison, since each model is linked to a certain hypothesis. And thirdly, I'll be talking about an application. So these models are useful for concrete and real data, and I'll be showing one example of that. And then finally, I'll be talking about some extensions that have been done in the last couple of years for both fMRI data and as well as EEG data. Okay, so what is the basic idea behind DCM? So DCM tries to estimate and make inferences about the coupling or the connectivity among different areas and how this coupling is influenced by changes in the experimental context. So basically DCM has two parts or two models within the same. And one is a neuronal model, which is obviously at the neuronal level, and that is represented here by Z. And but this neuronal activity has to be fed into the hemodynamic model, and here we use the balloon model, which I'll be mentioning in a second. And then finally, we have our observed responses. So just an overview of what this neuronal model is. Here, imagine this is a system within the brain, and these are our sources. And these sources have a certain dynamics described by a state equation, and the way these dynamics evolve also cause a Bold response. And of course, this system has to be fed with a driving input, which is usually your stimulus function. And you can also feed the system with a modulatory input, which is often attention versus non-attention. So the equation that describes this type of dynamics is written here, and this is just a differential equation that says that the rate of change of a state is dependent on the latent connectivity, which is the intrinsic connectivity, which is there due to however these areas are connected anatomically, and as well as a dependency on the modulation of connectivity, which are which is stored here in the B matrix, and the driving inputs. So so now, given this model, we then fed into the balloon model as developed by these people, and then we obtain our Bold signal, and these are just hemodynamic parameters which are important for the estimation, but we often not interested in those. So just to give you just a basic concept of what I'll be using afterwards. So I'll be calling state vector for these entities here, which just describe the neuronal activity. And the z dot is just a derivative as in respect to time, and is a function of the states themselves, the inputs, and all these are parameterized by thetas. And by thetas, I mean all the hemodynamic parameters, as well as the connectivity parameters, which are actually the ones we are interested on making inference about. So how do we integrate, so you saw before a differential equation, how do we integrate them to have our the function for the neural activity? So a general solution you can see here from this differential equation, what we obtain is exponential decay. And the rate of change of this this function is our definition of connectivity. So connectivity is often used in a kind of loose sense, and here this is what we mean. Is a rate constant, and has the dimensions of hertz, so seconds minus one. And this is just the relationship between this connectivity and the half-life, which is the time for which this function reached its half. Okay, so I'm going now to take you through a toy example, and starting by a very simple model which has two different nodes described by Z1 and Z2. And both of these nodes have intrinsic connectivity that change its own activity, and also extrinsic connectivity or coupling, which is parameterized by this constant here, A to 1. So let's look at this graph first. So if we set the intrinsic connectivity to be 4, and the relationship between these, the activity of Z1 and Z2 to be 1, then what we see is that the first source has this behavior, so it's exponential decay that eventually reaches equilibrium. And as for Z2, what happens is that it increases its activity and then eventually reaches stability again. Now, what happens if we manipulate the connectivity? So let's do the usual thing. We keep one variable constant and we change the other. So let's keep the intrinsic connectivity the same and change the extrinsic coupling, so the relationship between these two areas or how these are coupled. So we made this twice as coupled as in, as compared to the first graph. And what we observe is that for Z1, the activity stays the same, but the activity in the second source has increased. And this kind of makes sense because this area is twice as much coupled to the first. Okay, so now the third graph, it's a comparison between, let's look at the third and the first. So we keep now the extrinsic coupling the same, it's one. So and we just change the intrinsic connectivity. So this, what happens is that obviously it changes both Z1 and Z2, because S is a parameter associated with intrinsic of both. And you see that everything kind of happens much earlier in time. But you can see that the relationship between Z1 and Z2 stay the same, and this also makes sense because the connectivity parameter or the extrinsic connectivity is one, so the same as it has been before. Okay, so this is the previous one is very very simple, but it's we often not have something more complex than this. So now what changed here is that we now actually feed our system with an input. And this is your stimulus function. So, and we usually have a repetitive function. And you can see that the only thing that happened is that these dynamics repeated itself. And the same for Z2. And how is this expressed in terms of the dynamic model is that now we have a parameter. Now we have this matrix C here that includes as well the driving input as well as the intrinsic and extrinsic coupling. Now let's add just one more degree of complexity, and we introduce here a modulatory input U2, and so that has this shape, so say non-attending, attending a certain stimulus. And how does that change the activity of this dynamic system? So you can see that Z1 didn't change because, and it doesn't have a reason to, since the input appeared here in a connection starting in Z1 and finishing in Z2. But as for the second source, you can see that there is a change. And this dynamics is kind of damped where there's no input, and then again afterwards when there is no modulator input. And how is that expressed in terms of the equation? Well, you can see here there's U2 now, and there's a parameter that establishes or that creates a dependency on this activity as well as the input. So this is parameterized by B21. Okay. But we know that usually areas in the brain are reciprocally connected. So what happens when we have a sort of feedback loop system? So if we include this connection, and I should have mentioned before, this index means from area 2 to area 1, and here from area 1 to area 2. So what this changes is that both Z1 and Z2 increase its their activities. And how is it also, yeah, so the red is the system that you seeing now, and the blue was the system that I showed in the previous slide. And the connectivity model is as follows. So is everything as before, except for this parameter here, A12, that now links both areas. Okay, well, as I said before, the neuronal activity has to be fed into the HRF, and this is how it would look like if you have a neuronal dynamics that looks like the one in blue, then the bold response would look like this for both H1 and H2. And, well, everything would be nice if there wasn't noise, but with noise, that's what happens. It's still pretty good feed. Okay, so to summarize and make it general for all number of regions that you want to include in your model and connections, this is how it looks like. So here is this, the rate of change, the changes in respect to time of the activity, dependent by a matrix which stores the latent or intrinsic connectivity, and a dependency on both the states and the modulatory inputs, and the parameters that establish this relationship are stored in Bs. Which is the induced connectivity, which is context dependent, and then a matrix that encodes for the driving inputs. So this is an expansion of this equation that you've seen before. So so just to make it clear, this is for N regions, M modulator inputs, and M driving inputs. Okay, so I spoke before about all these parameters that we are interested in, which are the connectivity, the A's, the B's, and the C's. And here I just called them thetas, just to make it general. So these actually also include the hemodynamic parameters, even though we're not interested in making inferences on that. On them, they also are important for the estimation of the model. So we use a Bayesian framework to estimate our parameters. So we need to give an initial empirical priors, and we also have a likelihood term, and we combine these two to have our posterior distribution on the parameter. So in the end, what we have is a distribution like this, and with a given mean and a variance, and we often want to know what is the probability that this connectivity was bigger than a chosen threshold that, you know, it's biologically plausible, and the probability will be the area under this curve. Okay, so this is just a summary of how the parameters are estimated, and the way DCM does is to use a EM algorithm that tries to minimize the difference between the observations and the estimated by the models. Okay. So I spoke about the parameters, how do we estimate them, and then we can make inferences on the parameters in the usual classical way. And but we might also want to test different hypotheses. That's usually the case, that we have several hypotheses for the same system, and for that. We usually want to know which is the best model that explains our data. For that, we use a measure that includes both goodness of fits and complexity, because this is what this graph explains. So, of course, the more parameters you have in your model, the better your fit will be. So you see here you have an example for a certain fit, and this fit is not great. This one is quite good, but this one it's getting over. It's doing overfitting basically, because it's fitting the noise as well as the data. So if you acquire your data again in a different run, you won't have this model won't be very good, because it's fitting the noise of the previous run and not the noise of the second run. So we really want to be in the place that we have a good balance between the complexity of our model and the accuracy. So we want to be here, basically. Okay, so having said that, what we use is the log evidence that accounts for both accuracy and complexity. And what we do is to use the Bayes factor, which is a ratio between model I and model J, and it just says that how much model I is better than model J. And we usually use a number as 20. Okay, so this is useful and can be used to ask interesting questions. And for instance, this one done by Buckel and Friston, what they wanted to ask is does attention to motion affect the visual system? And they had two different hypotheses. One that attention modulation affects the connections between V1 and V5. So you see here the modulatory input is affecting this connection here. And the second model that tests the hypothesis, well, attention is actually changing connectivity between the prefrontal cortex and V5. And what was found was that actually the log evidence for model one is much better. So one can conclude, okay, so probably attention is modulating V1 and V5, or at least this model is better than this one. Well, I should probably say here that a good thing about a limitation and at the same time a good thing is that even though you cannot test for all the models, it's not exploratory, but it's more hypothesis testing. You cannot test for all your hypotheses, but if you have a set of hypotheses, you can test amongst them and come up with your best solution. Okay, so now going to the end of my talk, I'll be showing you some extensions for DCN that have been in the past couple of years. And one addressed the problem of different slice timing between different areas in your model. So say you acquired this slice for this area in one time, and then when you actually acquired the slice for this area, the time has passed and DCM has previously used didn't account for that problem. So usually 2 seconds was kind of a limitation where you could still do some analysis like this. But then Stefan Keeble introduced a model which already takes into account and corrects for the fact that these areas can be acquired in different TRs. Another important extension of DCM was made by André Marais. And what he did was to make this model a little bit more biologically plausible. What he did was to say, well, within one area, there are two subpopulations, excitatory and inhibitory populations, and these are connected, interconnected. And so, again, with intrinsic and, with self connections and with extrinsic connections. So in terms of the model, how does it look like? Well, as before, we had a connectivity matrix in which the diagonal encoded for the self connectivity. So, however, the area was connected to itself, and out of the diagonals were the parameters for the extrinsic coupling. And now, what he did was to expand one entry of this matrix into four, which encode for the connectivity parameters of the excitatory population with itself. This is this parameter here, and as well as the intrinsic inhibitory population with itself, which is this parameter here, and the extrinsic. Well, it's intrinsic because it's within an area, but it's kind of between different populations. Okay, so this is a kind of more biological model, and it has better stability properties. A third extension for fMRI was done by Klaas and Klaas Stefan, and what he did was to extend the model so that an area can have an impact on a connection instead of having a modulatory input function. Here we can also ask the question, is there modulations of one area into a connection directly? And simply, this is, in terms of the maths, what he changed was just to look at the Taylor series and add the next term, so just the second derivative. So you can see here, this has these three terms, so this is A, this is B, this is B, and this is C, and then he just added this one, this term, which is described here in the... the other extension, the final I'm going to talk about, is what Olivier David did for EEG data. And the model here at a neuronal level is much more complicated than the previous for DCM, for fMRI, sorry. And instead of one differential equation to describe the dynamics, you have basically nine differential equations that you have to solve. But on the other hand, the Ford model is much simpler than the hemodynamic model, which is basically just multiplying the states by a lead field matrix that is dependent on whatever sphere model you use and the conductivities of the different tissue layers. Now, we use this model to ask certain questions of cortical organization. For instance, we use the oddball paradigm, where we had standards and deviant tones, and we tested two different hypotheses that asked the question, is the ERP explained by forward and backward connections, or is it sufficient to have a model with just forward connections? And again, forward are the connections that link kind of low-level processing area with a higher area. So this emulates bottom-up, and whereas the backward connections are linked with the top-down effects. And we found that in the beginning, at a certain point, there's not much need on including backward connections in your model, but later on in time, they become more relevant. And so this is an example of questions you cannot ask with DCM for fMRI, because you don't have the time resolution for that. Another thing you can do is to, with the EEG, but not with fMRI data, is to test models with different number of sources. And the reason why is that for fMRI, the data is extracted from the regions of interest, so say each source, whereas in EEG you use the whole brain or all the electrodes information, so the data stays the same. And again, the Bayesian model comparison is valid given the data. So here we could test different connectivity models which are linked to certain theories for mismatch negativity generation, which I'm not going to talk about now. But so what we did was to design these models and to come up with the best model. Okay. So to summarize, how does the DCM work? So you usually have a hypothesis or several hypotheses about how your neuronal system works, and you want to test this hypothesis and specify a DCM that links to this hypothesis, and you design the study to investigate that system. It's of course very tempting to go backwards and have your data there and you just recycle it to ask a different question, but that will not always work. It might work. And then you do your data acquisition, you extract your time series, and you estimate your parameters. You can do Bayesian model selection to select between best models, and you can do statistical tests on the parameters for the winning model. So this is, I should have mentioned before, but we often select the best model and then we make inferences on the parameters of that model. And so what I've been talking about for the past half an hour or so was that in DCM we have two models, a neuronal model that is tries to explain the dynamics of the neuronal system, a hemodynamic model, and this form the state space model. And by inverting this model with an EM, which is fed with some empirical priors, and with the data being fMRI or EEG, in the end, what we can obtain is the posterior densities on the parameters and a measure of how good your model is that allows you to compare between different models. And that was all. Thank you.
Time for some questions. Clark?
I have a question about your slide that was denoted three applications. You have to put it back up. But there's a model there which has parameters, which I assume are something like linear parameters. And what I wanted to know was whether you could have written just taking the areas and taking the means of a region or first principle components and written these as you've got what is effectively an interaction term, but you could have written them as linear models plus an interaction term, and then estimated them by maximum likelihood or EM, and skipped all of the model building mm-hmm. behind the scenes. Would you have gotten significantly different results? Did mm-hmm. you do that?
Well, I guess that's an empirical question whether I'll have a different results. But as far as I understand your question, that wouldn't involve any biological plausible model.
That's right. You would just get. The question is, mm-hmm. would you get these results if you just skipped all of the mm-hmm. biological mm-hmm. plausible mm-hmm. model building and just did a covariance analysis mm-hmm. on the ROIs?
Mm-hmm. Again, it's an empirical question. I'll have to go and do it, but I don't think it will be as good as a model that is biologically informed, which and has parameters that...
Yeah, but it'd be easier.
Yes, it would be easier, but it might not answer your question.
I think in his 2004 paper, Will Penny did SEM on these same data, mm-hmm. right? And you get kind of roughly the same answer, mm-hmm. but I don't know if you can ask the same questions.
I want to ask you a question about what drives the identification in DCM. What drives the identification? What is the variation that is pinning down the parameters? And let me ask you with a concrete example.
Okay.
So suppose that you just have two brain areas and you're interested in whether one is driving the other mostly or vice versa. Is at the end of the day which timing comes first that is driving out the estimates? Is this just a matter at the end of the day of temporal timing, which comes first?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. What you're asking is what drives, how do we know which area drives which, and if it's not...
It's more basic than that. What is it about the variation in the data mm-hmm. that is pinning down whether the 812 or mm-hmm. the 821 are stronger.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is hidden in these parameters, I21 and I12, and well, it of course it's a temporal dependency as well, but I think it's not as simple as a normal regression because it has a differential equation, a dependency on a differential equation. I'm not sure if I explained.
I guess if you did the cross correlation between the input function and the two signals, I mean, you'll see that there would be a timing difference. I guess this is what you're
That's the way of asking the question. Yeah.
And there would
mm-hmm.
be a timing difference.
Mm-hmm.
But in age.
That's the same.
So in the model that you showed us, you mostly had roughly one latent variable per area that you're considering. But in limit, I can see a situation where we might want to consider adding one variable per particle pole. Of course, you don't have enough data to fit that. So I had two questions. One was, what is the practical limit in terms of how many variables you can expect to have something more realistic than mm-hmm. one per area? And on the other is, do you see that having other sources of information like EEG together with the MRI allow you to resolve into many more limits?
Mm-hmm. So do you mean so the first question is what is the limit in number of sources for DCM? So what people have done so far, I think the maximum was 6 areas. I'm not sure if you can go much further than that, whether you have stability problems. I think that's what people have done. And the second question was?
Whether if you had other information sources,
like right.
data for
mm-hmm.
the same task, whether that together with the MRI will
yes.
allow you to have more sources.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically saying if we have a certain task and we record it with EEG and fMRI, whether we'll have more information?
Yeah, because you have a full model. With,
mm-hmm.
So given the framework that you set up, you could add other information sources
mm-hmm.
without complications. So, I mean, has that been done? Is it something?
I think, right? No? I think Will Penny with Maria are trying to make a generative model for both EEG and fMRI, but do you want to comment?
There are some models already, like the CAN-T model,
mm-hmm.
neuronal activity, EEG signal, and then combining that with the human and the Bowman model.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, so that's a very interesting question. How do we do group analysis? What has been done so far is to multiply the base factors, and so the assumption there is that subjects are independent, and therefore the conjoint probability for the group is just a multiplication of probability for each individual subject. But this is equivalent to a kind of fixed effects analysis, so one subject can be driving the group, but this is what we have so far. But there's in process, class is doing a hierarchical model that has that takes into account variances between subjects. But you can also you can also then use those base factors to make classical statistics. So say to do an ANOVA, or you can do that.
I have two questions, and actually, if you refer to the second to the last slide, it's the second to the last. So the whole second, no, the second to the last of your whole talk.
Oh, okay.
Okay. The model, go back one, no, go forward one. Good. Okay. The model depends very heavily on the two boxes at the very top here. Okay. One is the neural dynamics, and the other is the hemodynamics. And there are two things that I think are going to color the output too much. One is that the solution to your differential equation, presuming that your driving function looks like a simple exponential. That's what linearizes that differential equation, which is the same as stating, I believe, that the neuronal population dynamics are AR1. They're just laggards, you get an exponential decay. I don't know what the support is for the idea that the neural dynamics are simply AR1, and therefore, if they're not, if you have a something other than a exponential form, your equations become nonlinear. Secondly, the hemodynamics are required to be both temporally and spatially stationary. And we have every reason to believe that that's not true. That is, if you look at the hemodynamic response function to simple pulsed inputs in visual cortex and compare them to somatomotor cortex, you have an entirely different response shape. And I wonder, I mean, I guess I question whether the whole thing solves under those circumstances. Mm-hmm.
Okay, the first question, sorry.
Well, more a comment than a question, I suppose, but what, you know, a question might be, what's your support for the idea that the neural dynamics are AR1 and look like a simple exponential?
Well, that was a general, okay, let's go back. This is a general solution for a simple equation that only has the rate of change for Z1 and a constant. But the solution for Z2, for instance, here, it's not an exponential decay. It's more complex than that. And it has this type of behavior. So this is just integrating the differential equation, whatever it looks like. And the reason why, one can say, why is this, of course, we assume that this parameter is negative. And why is that? It's because there's the underlying assumption that eventually, after a stimulus, then the brain would kind of reach to equilibrium.
But the solution for Z2 there depends specifically on the idea that Z1 has the functional form of e to the minus ax, or e to the minus at. If it doesn't, then that solution becomes nonlinear.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the reason that Z1 has an exponential decay is because you've modeled this as an AR1 process.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm not saying that this is the full model, but it's as best as we have done so far. So, I guess that is linked to. So you were saying that we just take the first terms of a Taylor expansion, where to fully explain the system, we would have to take the whole thing. This is what we can do just so far. And as for your second question, which was that...
This temporal and spatial stationarity of the balloon model.
Right. So that... there's some flexibility on calculating the HRF as well, since there's five different variables which give you some degrees of freedom for the HRF to move.
But you're holding them fixed in order to do these analyses.
In the estimation procedure, they can vary.
By region.
By region, yes.
So we're a little bit over time, so we should probably thank Marta again and then take a short break.